It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I saw a very interesting video, Orthodox Jewish rabbi saying, oh yeah, Trump will be reelected right now. This is just a little bump in the process. I want to play a few clips from that, see where he's coming from and why, and then give you some insight in terms of how Jews look at the world. Obviously, Jews are a diverse people like every other people, but certain general things in terms of how Jews look at the world and I'll just give you some insight, spiritual, natural insight. And if you have a Jewish-related question of any kind, it could be Hebrew-related, it could be about Israel today or Israel in prophecy, it could be a messianic prophecy question, whatever. If it's Jewish-related, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. If you're a Jewish person and you don't agree with me about my faith in Yeshua and want to dialogue with me about it, obviously we can't get into a full-blown debate, but by all means, give us a call. All right. You might sometimes wonder, as a non-Jew, why Jews are always thinking, okay, with the election, with this move in society, with how does it affect us? How does it affect the Jews? You'll see it regularly. You know, articles, okay, how would a Biden presidency affect the Jews? How did a Trump presidency affect the Jews? How is it going to affect us? You think, isn't that kind of self-centered, self-absorbed? No, you have to understand, when you are a small minority, right now, what, 0.005% of the world's population, whatever that exact figure is. So maybe 13, 14 million out of 7.5 billion. And when you have a history of being kicked out of countries because you don't fit, because you won't convert to the prevailing religion, and when you're hated and persecuted and so on, you want to know, how's this gonna affect me? How's it going to affect me? I mean, look, when there are economic changes, you hear some big thing, this is going to happen in this part of the world, and it's going to have this ripple effect. You think, oh, how's that? What's the bottom line for me? How's this affect my family or my ability to pay my mortgage or pay rent or put food on the table? And, you know, it's a natural thing. So Jews often think in that way. So there's a story about these three scientists who went to India. And they were going to spend 1 year researching the Indian elephant. And then after that, they were going to go back to their home countries and work on their research and then publish a book. One was from Germany, one was from France, one was from America. So they spent a year analyzing the Indian elephant, studying the Indian elephant. They all go back home, and then they do their research and writing at that point. So the German scientist, he does his research, and he publishes a book called 100 Ways to Categorize and Analyze the Indian Elephant. Now, if you know anything about German scholarship, it's often very precise and very analytical and very orderly. And if you know German society, it's very much like that. You know, trust me, they say the service will start at this time and the meeting will start at this time, and boom, it's prompt. And you know, very different than, say, Africa or India, just time can be more flexible. So the German scientist writes his study on 100 ways to categorize and analyze the Indian elephant. The French scientist writes his study on the romantic life of the Indian elephant. Ah, yeah, France, romance. The American scientist writes his study on 100 ways to build, not 100 ways, how to build a bigger and better Indian elephant. We can do it bigger. We can do it better. That's how we do it. Well, I was talking to a friend about this, and he said, yeah, there was a fourth scientist, an Israeli scientist. So he spent a year researching with him. He went back to Israel, and then he wrote his report. His book was called The Indian Elephant and the Jewish Problem. In other words, how does the Indian elephant affect us as Jews? It's understandable, again, when you are the minority, when much of the world through history is against you. You want to know, okay, how's this going to affect me? And, you know, you may be looking at elections, things happening around the world, But a lot of it's bottom line. How's this going to affect my family, economy, my freedoms? Bottom line kind of stuff, right? So it's understandable in that respect. Now, I'm looking at an article here. It's on a Prophecy Watch website. So it's a Christian website, but it's called Poking God in the Eye. Kamala Harris vows to fund Israel's enemies. And, of course, a very threatening-looking picture of her. In an interview with the Arab American News 2 weeks ago, Kamala Harris explicitly stated that she was committed to creating a Palestinian state inside the borders of Israel with its capital in Jerusalem, while limiting the number of Jews permitted to live in Judea and Samaria, in other words, the so-called settlements. The interview came during a previous campaign stop in Dearborn, Michigan, home to 40,000 Arab Americans and the largest Muslim population in the United States per capita. Joe and I believe in the worth and value of every Palestinian and every Israeli. We'll work to ensure that Palestinians and Israelis enjoy equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and democracy. We are committed to a two-state solution. We will oppose any unilateral steps that undermine that goal. We will also oppose annexation and settlement expansion, and we will take immediate steps to restore economic and humanitarian assistance to the Palestinian people, addressing the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza, reopen the UN consulate in East Jerusalem, and work to reopen the PLO mission in Washington. The PLO mission was closed after the organization violated its obligation to Congress not to target Israel at the International Criminal Court. The Trump administration was obligated by law to close the office once the Palestinians announced their plans to take Israeli officials to the ICC. Joe Biden has stated a commitment to these goals as well. Neither has stated any concessions that would be expected from the Palestinians in return. Okay, now, many Jews would be looking at that. Not just how does the presidency, and we'll see, again, we don't have the final vote count, the casting of the votes of the Electoral College. So when we have the final verdict, whoever the president is, then at that point, it's a valid question to say, how does this affect Israel? You say, don't you want equal rights for Palestinians and Israelis? Of course. Don't you want humanitarian treatment for all? Of course. But the problem, the biggest problem, is the corrupt Palestinian leadership. The biggest problem is the ongoing funding of Islamic terrorism. The biggest problem is lack of Islamic recognition of the Jewish right to a homeland. And to say, okay, if there's going to be a Palestinian state, it can't be free of Jews. You know, why is it that the Israeli state's got 1.5 million plus Arabs living in it, but if you have a Palestinian state, there'd be no Jews? So it's what this implies. It's where this goes. It's the give and take. It's the working towards a divided Jerusalem. Now, again, we shall see how things play out on the ground. And it's not the end of the world in any case, regardless of what happens next with the elections. You have a little faith that God sits on the throne and rules and reigns. At the same time, this would be a Jewish perspective. And again, for any of our groups, this is understandable. Those of us who are strongly pro-life, pro-family, pro-religious freedom, you know, we're asking, how does the election affect us? Others, you know, you're all looking at immigration, or you're all focused on education, or you're all focused on health care, and that's your question. How does the election affect these issues? So this is part of a Jewish perspective. Now, there's something else in a Jewish perspective which is very worldly wise. In other words, while it's spiritually oriented, and if you talk to a religious Jew, you'll find someone who is very spiritually minded and who thinks about prayer and God all day long, all right? The clothes they wear, the choices they make, the everything is God, 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 in terms of their consciousness of this is how I live as a Jew in this world. And yet there is a worldly wisdom to Judaism. There is a earthly practicality. So a couple of jokes. There is a Catholic priest, a Protestant pastor, and a Jewish rabbi. And they're discussing the philosophical question of when life begins. And the Catholic priest says, well, we're very clear on this, life begins with conception. Absolutely. The Protestant pastor, you know, there are a lot of different viewpoints in how we should interpret the Bible and understand it. So there's debate in our circles exactly where the process of the baby being conceived, before it's born, when life begins. They ask the rabbi, when does life begin? He goes, life begins when the children leave home. Okay, so it's not the answer to the question, but it's the Jewish joke in terms of kind of a simple pragmatism. And yes, Judaism teaches love for children. Or here is another one. The same three guys, the Catholic priest, Protestant pastor, and Jewish rabbi. they are asked, what do you do with the funds that come into your church and your synagogue? How do you divide them up? The Catholic priest said, oh, we draw a circle on the ground here. We draw a circle. And then we throw all the money that comes in, we throw it all up to God. And everything that falls outside of the circle, that belongs to God. And what falls in the circle, that's ours. Protestant pastor says, you know, we do something very similar, actually. We draw a circle on the ground. We throw all the money up to God. And what lands in the circle is God's. And everything that lands outside the circle is ours. The rabbi says, we don't even bother with the circle. We throw all the money up to God. What he wants, he keeps. Again, it's the Jewish type of practical wisdom. It reminds me, it's not a Jewish story, but just a practical story. There was a fellow I'd led to the Lord in high school, and he was getting married, and the church that we were attending had a big piece of property, and during the summer, they had put a tent up to have some tent meetings to just draw people in. They'd see the tent come in, do more evangelism, that kind of thing. The church building was all the way in the back of the property. And this fellow said, you know, my wife and I would love to get married under that tent. Oh, could you keep it up a little longer? And the pastor said, you know, we got some bad weather coming. It's fall. It can be a little dangerous for that tent. And he said, we're really praying and believing. Would you keep it up? The pastor said, okay. So I'm in the wedding party that day. And, well, bad weather hits. I mean, real bad weather. Now, we had gone the day before to a Methodist church building. And the guy there, the custodian in the building, didn't really seem like a spiritual guy. I don't even know if he was a believer or not. But taking care of the building. And they said, yeah, you know, we need this as backup just in case there's bad weather. But we're praying and believing that everything's going to be great and there won't be any problem. Well, sure enough, that day comes and the weather was so bad it ripped the tent up. And we get there and the water's pouring in and the guys are going around like with these towels trying to clean up the chairs and the water's pouring in. There's puddles everywhere. And the groom is just totally crestfallen. What are we going to do? We're all there in our tuxes and all this. And he said, right, last minute, can we move it over to the Methodist church? And we call over. The guy said, I polished the floor last night. I knew it was going to rain. There wasn't this revelation or the Lord spoke to me. He's like, yeah, I saw the weather. Of course I knew you'd be coming. I already polished the floor. Come on over. So that's kind of like a Jewish approach sometimes. Practical wisdom. All right. Phone lines are open now. I'm going to go right to the phones. We come back, 866-348-7884. And then I got these really interesting clips to play from this rabbi.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to The Line of Fire. Beautiful Hasidic singing of the Psalms. The one who sits, rules, watches over Israel, never slumbers or sleeps. Okay, 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. We go to Gavin in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome to The Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how you doing today?
Doing very well. Thanks, Gavin. What's up?
Hey, so if Jesus is used for Joshua in the Septuagint, mm-hmm. How do we know that Jesus' name isn't Yehoshua rather than Yeshua? Was Yeshua just a lot more popular in Jesus' day, and that's why we go with that?
Yeah, the reason as to why the Septuagint translated Yehoshua, Joshua, with Jesus, which is Yeshua, the reason for that is complicated. I've discussed it with Septuagint scholars. It just seems to be kind of a leveling out of the former, of the Yehoshua name, with the more common Jesus in Greek. Yeshua was a tremendously common name in the first century. But we have Yeshua close to 30 times in the Hebrew Bible for five different people, primarily as the short form of Yehoshua, the high priest. So it would be like Mike versus Michael. Jesus in Greek, and then the spelling in the Peshitta and Syriac indicates that the right pronunciation is Yeshua. There would be a final ah, so Yeshua. That gives us good indication. There is no indication that he would have been called Yehoshua. In other words, it's not reflected in the Peshitta. It's not reflected in other ancient documents we have. He's universally known a certain way in Greek. Whereas we do have, at least in the Hebrew Bible, and then in the Syriac would make a distinction between Yehoshua and Yeshua. So the combined evidence would suggest that somehow there is a leveling out of Yehoshua and Yeshua in the Septuagint, where it all just comes out as if it was Yeshua, Jesus, moving with a more common form, or the very common name of the day. Again, as I said, Yeshua being a tremendously common Jewish name in the first century. Beyond that, I'm not sure exactly why or how it happened. So your question is totally valid. It's just the combined evidence from everything that we have would indicate that the name was Yeshua, not Yehoshua.
Gotcha. Can I ask you one more quick question?
Yeah, go for it.
Do you believe verse 5 in Psalm 110 is about the same Lord in verse 1, like at the right hand of the Father? Or do you believe it's talking about, or they switch places?
Oh, okay. No, I'm not seeing a switch in places there. So let's just do this because of the brevity of this. What version should I read? Tell you what, I'll read NET. Just because folks can find ample notes. So the Lord, Yahweh, says to my Lord, so Ne'um Yahweh L'Adoni, so the utterance of Yahweh to my Lord, Adoni, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. So the Lord, Yahweh, sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter, rule in the midst of your enemies. So this is the heavenly Father making this decree for the Son. Your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power, and holy garments from the womb of the morning, the dew of your youth will be yours. So the you're taking to be this anointed Lord, this Messianic King. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is at your right hand. He will shatter kings on the day of his wrath. So what that's saying is here, it's not a switching of places. Because sit at my right hand is a place of affirmation and a place of secondary power to the Lord himself, right? You know, it would be the highest place in the universe, at my right hand. Now, it's interesting wording here, the Lord is at your right hand. That just means he's backing you. So you could read it in a very technical way that they're switching, but one is positional, sit at my right hand. The other is metaphorical of God backing you. That's what it means. The Lord is at your right hand. He'll shatter kings on the day of his wrath. He'll execute judgment among the nations, fill them with the hill. Right. And then the he after this is the Messiah, the Messianic King, the rest of the verses. He'll drink for the brook, by the
so
way.
So you think the Lord in verse 5 is Yahweh and not the Messiah?
Yeah, that's how I would understand it.
Okay.
But again, you know, it's the reason you normally say that, the Hebrew form Adonai, is different than the form in the first verse.
Right.
So this is the one that's normally exclusively used for Yahweh in the Hebrew Bible. Now, it could refer to the Son. In other words, the Son is also Adonai. But in this context, it's not, who is he with? In other words, if this is about the Messianic King, is that your right hand? Is that my right hand? Or, you know, whose right hand? And especially someone reading it, an ancient Israelite reading it, if they heard it vocalized like that, that's the text that they had learned, and they'd understand that to be Yahweh. And now he who said, sit at my right hand, is now backing you. He's standing with you, in that sense, at your right hand. But these are questions that show you understand the issues, so I appreciate that.
Sure. Thanks for your time.
All right, you bet. 866-34-TRUTH. By the way, we often have shows, especially our Friday show, many Thursday shows, where very difficult to get through. The moment a phone line opens, someone calls, and you may have tried to get through at different times, and it's frustrating. And you know, we do our best, as you know, to get to as many calls as possible, and to have YouTube chats and other things where we we try to give conduits so you can ask your questions and we can respond. And then you can always write to us at our website, AskDrBrown.org. We have a team that, spends time answering your questions, and certain questions will come to me to respond to. So we're here to help. Our ministry name, Ask Dr. Brown, is just that. We do our best to accommodate. But every so often, we'll have phone lines open, and folks don't realize. So now is one of those times. We have some phone lines open if you want to call in with a Jewish-related question. Or here, with a big smile. If you're watching, you can see it. If you're listening, you can feel it with a big smile. It's my Jewish friends that differ with me. Those who differ, Christian friends who differ with my views on Israel. Now is a great time to call to the Black Hebrew Israelites that mock and attack and call me an Edomite liar and every other kind of thing on YouTube. Why not call? Why be cowardly and just post behind some anonymous keyboard somewhere when there's a wide open invitation to call and use our platform? Everyone that we speak to. I was doing an interview yesterday, a podcast interview on one of our podcast outlets, and the fellow said, hey, since you started a podcast on our channel, we've got 1.3 million downloads of your program. So people listen, not of one program, obviously, but, you know, of many shows. People do listen. So if you've got something you want to say, here is your opportunity. We pay for the airtime. We pay for the platform, and you get to call. What do you think of that? 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. All right. Rabbi Isser Zalman Weisberg. I was not familiar with him before. To my knowledge, he is not a famous rabbinical leader that people are looking to all around the world. In other words, you know, one of the, you call him Gedolim, one of the great respected rabbis of the generation that everyone goes to. But he may be well-respected in his circles. I'm just not familiar with him. So these clips that I play, I am not playing clips of someone who is widely recognized as a major spokesman for Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox Judaism in America or Israel, but he may be widely respected within his own circles. But just want to give you a context. In other words, this is not a rabbi that would have, say, the reach and scope of, say, Franklin Graham in the Christian side of things, okay? But he's not, you know, Westboro Baptist, God hates fags. He's, all right, so just, he is who he is, you can evaluate accordingly. So he had predicted Trump's election and sees Trump as playing an important role and even tying with the end times and Messiah and all of that, obviously from a Jewish perspective. So let's hear some of what he has to say about where we are with the elections right now.
In previous videos, I have predicted that Trump will be given more time to continue and complete the mission he was entrusted by God. In this video, I want to explain why his path to victory has taken a detour. There are many times in our history when it looked like the end was near, and then suddenly, Yeshua is Hashem keheref ayin, the salvation of God appears out of nowhere. You remember when we stood at the edge of the sea with nowhere to go, and the massive army of Pharaoh, armed to the teeth, were eager to exact revenge against the Jewish people. You know the story. Stand by for miracles.
Ah, so he's saying, hey, we've been in a situation with our backs against the wall before, and God's come through with miraculous intervention. Now, here's the thing I just want to emphasize. We do not need Donald Trump as president to save America. We do not need the Republicans or the Democrats or anybody else in power to save America or to save Israel. God, in fact, may do things in such a way that we lose hope in everybody and only put our trust in him. So it's interesting, though, that he and many others feel that the reelection of Trump is of tremendous importance for Israel and the world. May the will of God be done. May the will of God be done. To that, we can all say amen. And we put our trust in God, not a person. We come back. I'm going to go to your calls and play a couple more very interesting clips from this rabbi. Stay right here.
Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We still have some room left for our March trip to Israel. So it's right at the end of February and then the first week of March. Go to AskDrBrown.org to find out more. Originally, it was going to be May. Then we had to move it to October. Now, March, we're trusting by then everything will be good and back in order in Israel. But if you haven't signed up, please do so. It is the trip of a lifetime. You'll see it's worth every dime. All right, I'm going to go to the phones in a moment, but just want to play two more clips from this ultra-Orthodox rabbi, part of Chabad, which is a Hasidic sect of Judaism. And it's interesting, you know, Christian websites seem to have picked up on this maybe more than Jewish websites, but these are his predictions about Israel and Trump and what's coming. So let's, and this is what, about 3 days old in terms of when he posted this. Go ahead.
Americans who voted for Trump understood that his unflinching and unparalleled support for Israel is based on a moral imperative and has nothing to do with politics. How does Joe Biden intend to keep the faith of those voters and the other half of Americans who believe the exact opposite? How can he both protect the world from the fanatics of Iran, as President Trump has and will continue to do, while at the same time he embraces and emboldens Iran, as his mentor Barack Hussein had done, and allows them to continue with their diabolical plans to produce nuclear weapons, which will put the lives of over 6 million Jews in peril? How can you fight to protect the lives of unborn children and at the same time fight for the right of women to choose to kill them? Of course he can't. So why did he say that he can?
So he's challenging Joe Biden's speech from last Saturday night, where he says, in his view, as president-elect, you know, I'm going to be the president of all Americans, fight for all of you. Well, obviously, you want to say that. The president's supposed to be the president of all Americans. But if they're radically competing agendas, totally different agendas, you know, that are at loggerheads, that are mutually exclusive, you can be the president of all those people, but you can't support all the agendas of all those people, and that's, you know, that's what he's challenging. All right, one more clip.
Even if you raise your nest as high as the eagles, even if you establish it among the stars of heaven, I will bring you down from there, declares God. This is why I believe that they were given a temporary sense of victory to swell their egos as high as the stars, and from there they will come crushing down in shame and defeat. This will be their atonement, so that, as the Book of Ovadia concludes, those who survive, meaning after atonement has been achieved, all Americans can be part of those who will ascend to Mount Zion, and then the kingdom will be God's.
So he's tying in God bringing down the proud, and then tying that in with God using Trump and the end times and Messiah. I'm not looking at things in such messianic terms, but if God resists pride, then he resists pride in Donald Trump too. And I've been getting some very strong emails, texts sent to me by friends and colleagues saying, you know, there's been so much prayer for the president, you know, to protect him against this and that. What about prayer for the man to change? Because God does resist the proud. More thoughts. Hey, my prayer is, Lord, your will be done, which is a trillion, billion, infinite times bigger than me or you or America or Trump or Biden or anybody. So Lord, your will be done, and then let us be on the right side of your will. Let us align rightly with you with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Keith in Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Good afternoon, Dr. Brown.
Good afternoon.
I recently was part of a group where a coworker started this group with the intent of a couple fellows at work having some iron sharpening time together each week. And this is a guy who I've known for many years, a godly man, and he revealed to us that he and his family have become Torah observant Christians. And this is something he feels very strongly about and believes it is a necessity. And we've looked at some of Paul's writings where it discusses continuing to obey the law. And my question to you is what are your thoughts about this? Is this something that you really believe is necessary to achieve salvation?
He is on a very dangerous path, a very dangerous path that could ultimately lead to him completely denying Yeshua and even converting to Judaism. The moment you say it is necessary, it is required, you are in very serious error. And this is what happens. People realize that they've had a reaction against the law, that they look at the law as evil, whereas Paul said it's holy, just, and good. They see that Jesus said, I didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill. And they begin to think, well, you know, what about Sabbath? Who made it Sunday? Fair question. And, why should I eat food that God said is unclean? Well, it's another question, you know, that comes. And then goes on. Next thing people think, in order to please God, you know, it says, hey, if you love me, keep my commandments. Well, that means all 613. As opposed to what Jesus was saying in context, if you love me, keep my commandments, then the things I'm saying to you, love one another as I've loved you, and so on, you know, follow in my footsteps and listen to my commands. And then they begin to think, okay, I need to start living under the law. And then they start to think it's required to live under the law. And then they think others are required to. And I've watched it. You know, I've been in the Lord almost 50 years now. And as a Jewish believer, I've seen this for years. I'll get the letters. In the old days, the letters, now the emails. Dr. Brown, what do I do? My husband or my wife or my kids have renounced Yeshua. They no longer believe in him. And, you know, and so the fact is, we are not under the Sinai covenant in the New Testament. And God takes the new covenant and writes his laws on our hearts. And that is what's reflected in the New Testament writings. And in other words, if you're going to be under the law and Torah observant, then you need to be advocating for the rebuilding of the temple so that there can be animal sacrifices again. If you're saying that, then you are nullifying the work of the cross, saying we need animal sacrifices again. And I've watched with concern people fall into this more and more. Yeshua is no longer central. Torah becomes central. They will not be sharing their faith to lead people to Jesus. They'll be trying to get people to observe Torah. You will see a lack of worship in their lives in terms of, hey, you know, can we sing one of those hymns that just, you know, really lifts up Jesus? No, because they start to go in a different direction. Then they start to kind of find Jewish identity. They start to dress like Jews. You give it enough time, the guy will start wearing a yarmulke, even though it's got nothing to do with the Bible. It's just Jewish custom. It's one thing to say, hey, you know, God never changed this Sabbath, so I'm not going to keep it on the seventh day. Great. God bless you. And, you know, why eat certain foods? Maybe there's a reason God said they're unclean. Fine. New Testament makes clear that they don't affect us spiritually. They don't defile us spiritually. But fine, if you don't want to eat, great. I don't, you know, great. Good for you. That's totally different than saying that God requires Gentile Christians to observe the law. And the bottom line is, there are 101 ways they don't observe it. You know, are they going to stone a disobedient, rebellious child? Do the women live by every purity law that's there? And, you know, they pick and choose for the most part. You sit down with a religious Jew that examines their lives, they'll tell them you keep only a fraction of the laws. So it's a very dangerous road, and you watch it. If you're really close to them, you may not see it, obviously, but if you didn't see the person for a year or two, when you see them, unless they get their bearings and start going in the right direction, it's going to be real trouble. And that's the reason that Paul wrote Galatians, because that was a heretical view that they fell into. And Paul called them foolish and said, you've fallen from grace. So it's very serious.
Thank you very much. I think the intent was very good behind his reason for doing it, but I certainly understand a little more now where you're coming from, and it does help me to figure out how I want to respond to him whenever he brings these things up. So I appreciate the input from you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and listen, I'm not saying he's there yet, but if he keeps going this way and says it's mandatory, or God wants this, or says to you something's wrong with your life because you're not doing it, he's already crossed a dangerous line. If he brings it up, unless you can help him, you know, see things better, understand things better, you know, go through Hebrews with him, go through Galatians with him. But unless he is willing to hear, if he brings things up, best say, hey, let's just talk about Jesus. Oh, no, you can't talk about Jesus without talking about Torah. You'll see where the focus is. And then he'll read Galatians, completely turn it upside down in its meaning. And anyway, I've watched it happen way too many times. And just one passage I want to read to you from Colossians, the second chapter. There is a warning there about people putting these Gentile believers under pressure to observe the Sabbath or the like. And look at this very interesting thing Paul says in Colossians, the second chapter, verse 16. Therefore, don't let anyone judge you in regard to food and drink or in the matter of a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day. In other words, don't let them put you under pressure. You got to keep the new moon. You got to do this, that. These are a shadow of what was to come. The substance is the Messiah. Let no one disqualify you, insisting on ascetic practices and the worship of angels, claiming access to a visionary realm and inflate it without cause by his unspiritual mind. He doesn't hold on to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and held together by its ligaments and tendons, develops with growth from God. If you died with the Messiah to the elemental forces of this world, why do you live as if you still belonged to the world? Why do you submit to the regulations? Don't handle, don't taste, don't touch. All these regulations refer to what is destroyed by being used up there, commands and doctrines of men. So the key thing is holding on to the head. Hey, thank you for the call. Let me say this one last thing. Jewish believers who feel called in particular to live in deeper identification with their people and who say, hey, God never changed the calendar. Why shouldn't we celebrate the death and resurrection of Messiah in the midst of Passover? Why should we separate it as a separate holiday called Easter? Why shouldn't we meet on Saturday in our congregations for our worship and adoration instead of Sunday? Wonderful. God bless you. And if you're a Gentile Christian, say, I'd love to worship with my Messianic Jewish friends and join in as one in Yeshua and recover our Jewish roots. Wonderful. That is very different from saying that in order to be pleasing and right in God's sight, you must observe the Torah. You must come under the Sinai covenant, or the new covenant is just the Sinai covenant written on our hearts. Those are very, very different positions. All right, back with more of your calls. 866-34-TRUTH. And, oh, one quick announcement when we come back. All right, so your calls, quick announcement before that.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, one reason we play these clips at the beginning of Thoroughly Jewish Thursday that are not Messianic Jewish clips, that may be traditional Jewish, is a reminder of the prayers that are going up from the Jewish community, traditional Jews, religious Jews, day and night, prayers for redemption, prayers for forgiveness, prayers for the coming of the Messiah. And to just caricature, well, they're just legalists, they're just hypocrites, they're just this or that. Oh, you got legalist hypocrites everywhere. Ever been to church? Got them everywhere. But it should be something that's heartbreaking that they're very sincere, devoted people who in their minds and hearts are really seeking to please God and honor him, who don't believe in Jesus because they believe they'd be disobeying God to believe in Jesus. And that should break our heart and move us to prayer. Paul spoke of some of his compatriots in Romans 10 and said they have a zeal for God, not according to knowledge. That's how those traditional Jews would see me. They'd say, I have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. Obviously, that's how I see them. So we pray for them as followers of Yeshua. All right, back to the... that's not the announcement. Just a reminder, we've made it as simple as possible for those who believe in the ministry work we're doing and are helped by it to donate just on social media. So if you're watching on our Facebook page, Ask Dr. Brown, you'll see a donate button. Click on it. Any gift of any size goes a long way. You'd be amazed if folks do it every day and help out this one here, this one there. It really makes a difference and helps us with some amazing new outreach projects and things we're working on that can really touch a lot of people, especially some Jewish outreach we're working on. Your gifts help with that. So on Facebook, click on the donate button. Your gift of any size makes a big difference. Over on YouTube, you'll see a dollar sign under the chat section, chat box. Click on that, or you can go to our website, AskDrBrown.org. Click on donate. Okay, we go to Samuel in Daytona Beach, Florida. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Shalom, Dr. Brown. How are you doing today?
Doing great, thanks.
All right. That last question about the being Torah observant, I really did appreciate that, your answer and everything. My question is, it's actually concerning the book that you wrote called Jezebel's War with America.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was very necessary. It really was enlightening to me, and I'm still reading it. It's both saddening and motivating for prayer at the same time. I was just wondering, because you've written so many books, and I'm not aware of all they are. Have you written a similar book concerning Israel and what's going on, how the enemy is trying to attack Israel? Are you planning on writing one that's similar to this?
Not in the Jezebel way. In other words, not from that same angle. Mm-hmm. But my book coming out in February, Christian Anti-Semitism, is a real eye-opener about satanic attacks coming against the Jewish people from within the church and professing Christians and a mm-hmm. rising tide of that. So that's called Christian Anti-Semitism. It can be ordered now online, but that comes out in February. Or the book that's become kind of a classic, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, which goes through church history and then talks about ongoing attack on Israel and the Jewish people. So either Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, the new edition, which came out last September, or mm-hmm. Christian Anti-Semitism, which will come out in February. Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, you can get to our website, Christian Anti-Semitism. We don't have up on the website yet, but it is available online like Amazon or Christian Books. So either Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, give you the past history as well in greater depth, or Christian Anti-Semitism focuses even more on what's happening today. And thank you, Samuel, for the good word. Appreciate it. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Elizabeth in Mineral Wells, Texas. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, great. I've listened to your show for a couple of years now, probably more than that. But my interest had been piqued at my home church, where our pastor in Arlington, Texas, was starting to teach more of the Torah. Now, I have three questions. I originally told her two, but I have three now. The first one being, do Jewish people speak in tongues? Do they speak in tongues? The next one, I'm just going to give them to you real quick, okay, so you can explain.
Yeah, sure.
I'm excited to be able to talk to you. Anyhow, the second one is the box on the door, the one that they put on the door as you go in and go out. What is that for, and why do they do that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the third one is the most important, and it resonates with me, period, because that is what I'm in. Does Jewish people believe in deliverance ministry?
Okay, so, So number one, do Jews speak in tongues? No, they don't believe in what we call glossolalia. They don't believe in the Holy Spirit moving on them and empowering them to speak a new language. So prayers are prayed in Hebrew, or you can pray, you know, your own words, your own language. But no, they do not believe in speaking in tongues. That's specifically a New Testament Christian phenomenon. You have some parallels, you know, other religions and cults will claim to have a similar experience, a counterfeit experience. But no, that's not found in Judaism. The question, you know, you said is the most important. The third one, the deliverance question. No, the way that you're thinking of it, the way that you're thinking in terms of, you know, you go to someone and say, hey, I'm struggling with demonic oppression. You know, I've got this stronghold in my life. Can you pray? And we drive demons out. You know, the person's not saved. Drive demons out of them or break a demonic stronghold in their lives. No, that's not a concept that's found either in Judaism. Now, traditional Judaism does emphasize aspects of the spiritual realm, does believe there are demons, have certain superstitions. but the idea of like exorcism, it was, you know, in the ancient Jewish world, we know it was practiced. We know there are references to it in the New Testament. But the idea of the parallel you're thinking about within the church setting is not something you'd find in Judaism. You wouldn't find that a parallel in modern Judaism today. And just restate your second question.
I was wondering what the box was that they would kids going in and out.
Right. So
I don't know. I'm in Texas, so we're all Texas over here, and I don't know any Jewish people at all, and I don't know nothing about none of that. But
all right. So here's what you do, Elizabeth. Right. Stay there. When work call is over, Rachel is going to get on the line with you, and I have a book called 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. I'm going to send you that as a gift. It's called 60 Questions.
Thank you.
Sure thing. Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. And others interested in it, hey, get the book. So here's the deal, Elizabeth. It is called the mezuzah. And what it is, it's that little box, as you mentioned, and it has written within it passages from the Torah. For example, as Exodus 12, God tells the Israelites, you know, write these laws on your doorposts. And from what we can tell in the ancient world, they would literally write certain things, you know, on the doorposts in the house or in the threshold, over a period of centuries that developed into writing some of these verses on tiny scrolls, then wrapping those scrolls up and putting them in these little boxes. And then putting them on the wall. So when you walk in, any room you walk into in a traditional Jewish home or building will have these. And a traditional Jew will touch it with his hands and then kiss their hands. So it's reverence for Torah, remembering the commandments. And then on the outside is the shin, which stands for Shaddai, so Almighty God. And then the question is, why is it at an angle? And the story is, well, there is a debate. Should it be this way or that way? So they kind of left it in the middle. But it has within it, if you opened it up, you'll see within it, passages from the Torah, like Exodus 12, that mention this custom of writing it on the doorpost. So it's a way of remembering, always remembering God, remembering the commandments. All right, stay there, Elizabeth, and Rachel will get your contact info. All right, Brian in Winston-Salem. Time is short, so dive right in with your question, please.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. I understand, and I welcome your correction on any of these details if I misunderstand them, that when Jesus quoted the Old Testament scriptures, he would have quoted them from the Septuagint. And yet I've been told that our modern Old Testaments that we have in my Bible, for instance, are translated from the Masoretic text.
Yeah, who told you that he would have? Yeah, who told you he would have quoted? Where did you hear he would have quoted Septuagint?
It was in an article that I read, and forgive me for not remembering source of the article now.
No, it's 100% massively unlikely that was the case.
He's
a Galilean Jew whose first language would have been Aramaic, and he would have known Hebrew as well. When he'd go into a synagogue, say in Galilee, and pick up a scroll, he'd be picking up the Hebrew scroll and reading it in Hebrew. When he'd be dialoguing with Pharisees and other religious groups in Jerusalem, they'd either be dialoguing in Aramaic or in Hebrew. Some would have known Greek. Many would not have known Greek. There are even books written. Did Jesus speak Greek? You know, there's even debate about that. We know that
one thing that author said is he said that Jesus would have almost certainly spoken Greek at that time.
Even if he did, that's highly debatable, especially as a Galilean Jew. It's highly debatable. But even if he did, the scriptures that they'd have in the synagogue, when he opens the scroll and reads, that's going to be, he's reading from the Hebrew. And ultimately, we have the Gospels and the New Testament written in Greek, so things are primarily using the Septuagint in the Greek New Testament. But that's just because that's the translation that was most widely used, so if you're reading it in Greek, that's what you have. But certainly Matthew knows the Hebrew, and certain times is translating straight from the Hebrew and not using the Septuagint, like Matthew 8:17 and other places. So absolutely not. Jesus would have been quoting the Hebrew Bible in Hebrew. Feel certain about that. All right, back with you with your questions tomorrow.